I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source. In the annals of Boston medicine, two historic chapters in the last 50 years were surely the near conquest of sudden death by heart attack and, not unrelated, the rise of corporate cathedral hospitals around the practice of heroic scientific medicine with a huge arsenal of new drugs, surgical procedures, bypasses, catheters, stents, and all the rest. This is the stuff of our guest Tom Lee's biography of a giant cardiologist and an expanding industry in Boston. His book is Eugene Braunwald and the Rise of Modern Medicine. It's a complex and fascinating tale. Don Berwick, a doctor who's running for governor, will cover the downsides all around this story. Overtreatment for some, undertreatment for many, intrusions of finance, and breakdowns in the humanity of doctoring, and of course the gigantic expense of it all. We're talking this hour about Boston's bluest of blue chip industries, medicine, in a prosperous, maybe triumphant time that could also be the moment for rethinking and reform. Perhaps the core question is, where is the better medicine that would make all of us healthier, even without miracle surgery? Tom Lee, welcome. Tom Lee's an internist cardiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital. 6 months ago, Tom, I had the dimmest notion of Eugene Braunwald. Now I've read your book and met the man at the center of the story. But it's really two stories, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. There's a fantastic, complicated story about a person, you know, someone who's had as glorious a career as one can imagine in medicine. But it's not like he had a plan and it just rolled out. You know, he had plans, but history kept happening to him. Hitler invaded Austria. There were Jewish quotas and nearly kept him out of medical school. The Korean War inductor draft, Ronald Reagan becoming governor. You know, history kept derailing his plans, and he regrouped and pushed on and ended up making a big contribution. But the other fascinating, complex story is the world in which he worked. You know, modern medicine was poised for progress, and with contributions from him and many others, it became an aggressive, interventionalist, active field where we could actually change what the future might be for patients. And that's led to an explosion of knowledge, an explosion of things that we can do. And there's been great progress, but there are side effects to that progress, as you alluded to, which I'm sure we'll be talking about.
We will. You know, the immigration piece is, we could talk for months about that, not least the fact that you're the child of immigrants, Chinese immigrants. But let's just hold that maybe for another time. But go back to the moment. Well, I'm just thinking, as you describe, Gene Braunwald, these guys are all sort of buccaneers, incredibly driven, shall we say, egomaniacal tendencies, but the sense of adventure is, for me, captured somehow in the book in the early days. This would have been in the 50s, but they discovered they had this sort of catheterization club, practically, among the practitioners. And they've just figured out that you can put intravenously almost human intelligence right smack into the heart and look around. Describe that moment and the drive that takes people there.
Well, you know, it is a hugely important transition you're talking about, because the old world of medicine, as recently as the first half of the 20th century, the philosophy was a passive one where you just didn't want to cause harm. And the idea of sticking something into the heart was a ridiculous idea. And, you know, people looked down on anyone who would suggest it. And the first person to actually do a cardiac catheterization was a, frankly, out of control German urology resident who stole a catheter and stuck it into his own heart, a guy named Werner Forstmann. He ended up sharing the Nobel Prize for doing cardiac catheterization with a couple of real researchers. But the basic philosophy was, don't touch the heart. Don't mess with it. It's too delicate. The risk of doing harm is so great. And that changed over the course of the second half of the 20th century, and that's part of what we're talking about tonight.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that there's almost a hymn to intervention in this book, and it verges on, as you suggest, a kind of manic arrogance.
Well, you know, and I wouldn't say much. Oh, you know, there was definitely an audacity to it. And,
okay.
And because really you know, watching and not doing harm very much was the culture, because there frankly wasn't much you could do. But as the second half of the 20th century came along, it became clear that you could change the future for individual patients. You could open vessels that were blocked and reduce mortality from myocardial infarction. Mm. I mean, despite whatever, you know, side effects of progress, you know, we're going to talk about tonight, we do have to remember that death rates from heart attack did fall from like 30 to 40% in 1960 to about 5 to 8% today. So, you know, we can all remember where heart attacks were bolts from the blue and people just died and that was it. But today, it's a very, very different story. People still have to die eventually. But how many people do we really see dying in their 50s of heart attacks now? I mean, it's uncommon. You know, it's much more, you know, it's much more disease which can be attacked. Mm. We can attack the heart attack. And actually, Eugene Braunwald was the guy who showed that that was possible.
I was just thinking, lots of people listening to this program have walked down that sort of all-star corridor at the Brigham and Women's Hospital with those giant Karsh portraits of the, you know, the all-time all-stars. Put Gene Braunwald and his human qualities in that league.
Well, you know, there have been a lot of great figures that have walked the corridors of, frankly, all the Boston institutions. And, you know, you walk that corridor and you see the people who did the first renal transplant 60 years ago. You see people, you know, go to Boston University and you see pictures of, you know, the term risk factor was only introduced 50 years ago this year. That's when the Framingham study came out and they showed that cholesterol and high blood pressure contributed to heart disease. And probably we could prevent heart disease. So, you know, these were all people who changed history. And, you know, and they come from our community and we should be very proud of it.
What's the common thread in the personalities?
Well, I think that it's people who wanted to answer important questions, who did not accept the status quo, who did believe the future could be changed, and had the audacity to try to do it. Mm. Now, sometimes their audacity, you know, did blur into arrogance and some crazy things were tried over the years. But without trying, without pushing the envelope doesn't get bigger.
Dr. Braunwald gave me an hour in his office the other day talking about his 64 years of doctoring. Main theme was how little was known really when he started out about the inner workings of the heart until those catheters and doctors' fingers got inside it. World War II, he said, was a turning point. And a number of very young Boston doctors in London on military duty were part of the story. The late Dwight Harkin, I knew and remember with great affection, I must say, he pulled bullets and shrapnel out of the hearts of 130 GIs, and they all lived, according to him. But here's Dr. Braunwald.
What actually happened was that chest surgeons and chest surgery at the beginning of World War II was basically surgery for tuberculosis. And there was a lot of it at that time, even though streptomycin was on the scene. When they went into the military and then when they came to the front, they encountered patients who had been shot and with bullets remaining in the heart, but alive. And so the chest was mangled. They'd open the chest and then they would extract that bullet from a beating heart. They'd never done that before. And that is how they became heart surgeons. And they came back and said, okay, now we have done this. I think it was in 1945, so 3 years after the war, when Dwight Harkin, whom I knew well, and another surgeon working virtually at the same time, Charles Bailey in Philadelphia did the first mitral valve surgery quite successfully. And both of them had come back from the war and had learned at the front that you can operate on the heart. The concept of operating on the heart was ridiculous to surgeons. So all of this was building up. And the problem was the greatest problem, the greatest health problem in the nation and in the industrialized world.
That was Dr. Eugene Braunwald. Tom Lee, Dr. Tom Lee in our studio, wrote the book, Eugene Braunwald and the Rise of Modern Medicine. Talk about that other story, though, Tom. He speaks of the breakthroughs, but what about the bloat? What about the institutional, overcapacity, overtreatment, all the things that people despise about medicine and this system now, including what's happened to their own doctor-patient relationship? What are the connections between, the progress and the problem?
Well, they are intertwined, the way I see what's happened is that, we came out of World War II optimistic, wanting to live good, long lives, feeling like we could do anything, feeling like we could put a man on the moon. And we invested heavily in research, and there've been tremendous advances as a result. Knowledge has exploded, and what's happened is to deliver state of the science care. It takes so many people that with narrower and narrower fields of knowledge that we actually end up having chaos a lot of the time with people not working well together. And we have people whose expertises are very, very focused on one organ or even one aspect of one organ. And do they feel like their job is taking care of a human being? Sometimes they forget that. I'd be the first to admit that.
You wonder, it's not so much have we gone too far in the sciences, it's have we somehow missed the point of the inquiry?
Well, I think that's not right. I mean, I think that I'm an optimist, and I think the overall arc of the story is a good one. There's tremendous progress, and we have to figure out how to, bring back the total patient into care. And I think everyone, including Eugene Braunwald, gets that. But, we would never want to go back. I mean, when you think about the progress that's occurred, think about John Lester getting non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in September 2006 and being at spring training in February and pitching a no-hitter the next year.
The sports metaphor is a problem. I call it the Tom Brady syndrome. We can put a guy into combat every week and remake his knees on the weekend, but we'll come back.
The point I want to make is that disease was uniformly fatal when I was in training. You don't want to go back to when non-Hodgkin's lymphoma was fatal.
We're talking about the miracle medicine of the last 50 years, much of it hatched in Boston hospitals. How's to explain those breakthroughs alongside this huge gap in well-being? Don Berwick joins us. He's a pediatrician and a public servant who oversaw the administration of Medicare and Medicaid for the Obama team. And now he's running for governor in Massachusetts, just in from a candidate's debate in Lexington. Thank you for being here, Don Berwick. It's part of your pitch that technocracy in medicine has taken over. We've got a sickness-oriented, not health-minded system that leaves the patient out, and we, of course, pay a huge price for it. $27 billion wasted in Massachusetts in 1 year, according to this new health policy commission. Highest per person spending in the country right here in Massachusetts. In a society that, we read again, 30% is obese. Make some connections here. I mean, it could drive you nuts, but you study it systematically. What are the important links?
Thanks for having me, Chris. First, I want to celebrate the miracles, just like Tom does. I think I took care of patients.
We've done that now.
Absolutely. But there's a misplaced investment here. Of the $2.8 trillion we're spending in American healthcare, it's almost all for the fixing part, for the kinds of miracle production that Tom talked about and that Braunwald really helped us do in the field of cardiology. But if you do the math, we need a different kind of investment. At least in two ways. The first is that most of the burden we have on our healthcare world is chronic illness. That's 70 or 80% of the cost. And there are going to be no particular miracles for that. You can't get into the heart and fix that for people who are recovering from strokes or have diabetes or asthma or chronic care. They need journeys through their care. We need to build a care system that's absolutely continuous, where people aren't forgotten, where memory and journeys and joy in life are really celebrated and not being in a hospital bed or doing a procedure. And we don't really have a system built for that, and the cost is absolutely enormous.
I heard you at the overtreatment conference in December, and you were talking about that's a particular kind of waste, but it hurts people in a particular way too. Explain what you mean by overtreatment. I want Tom Lee to sort of measure it in his own world, but how does that work?
Pure overtreatment, that's simpler, and Tom would agree with me on this. There are all sorts of conditions for which interventions don't help, or we don't match the intervention to the need. A simple example is people who have virus infections can't benefit from antibiotics. Antibiotics don't kill viruses. But if you study patterns of antibiotic use, we overwhelmingly treat people with viral infections with antibiotics. Our early imaging use in back pain, we absolutely know that doing an MRI or a CAT scan in the first phases of back pain, it doesn't help. It actually hurts because then you get up into other interventions. So this predilection to use technology to get in there to do something instead of to let nature take its course, its early course, its benign course, let healing occur, that gets in our way. And that's just one form of waste.
It sounds like mission creep, invented a high-end procedure to deal with a rare disease, and suddenly everybody finds some reason to prescribe it.
Yeah, the miracle cure, which works for some, creates an industry interested in trying out that cure, and it extends to more and more people for whom the evidence isn't there. The creep is beyond the evidence we have to use it, and so technologies tend to get more and more used even when there isn't a lot of evidence for their effectiveness. And, of course, there are economic stakes there because the companies that make them, the inventors that own them, they're not necessarily bad people, but they absolutely would want to believe that what this extension is a good thing.
Would you talk about you talk about industry influences, lobbies, but more particularly, and it comes through in your book, Tom, about Eugene Braunwald, the penetration of this whole, I hate to call it an industry, profession, by big pharma, big manufacturing, for-profit industries. The whole industry may be called nonprofit, but it's a hugely rich world. Address that.
The money goes where the money is. And if our payment system pays for procedures and for this use of technologies, then of course more and more people invest in that, then you get more use of technologies. And the technologies begin to overtake the main enterprise, which is the enterprise of healing. The opposite case is prevention. As Tom well knows, probably 400% more variation in your health is determined by things in your behavior, choices you make, the substances we use, inequity, injustice, poverty in society. Healthcare is probably, you know, one-tenth of the variation in our health status. Where's the money going there? Where is the investment going to be in our stopping the obesity epidemic?
Well, what's the answer?
It needs to go there. We need to readjust the way we think about care so that instead of waiting for someone to get ill and then trying to rely on a miracle to cure them, which actually doesn't work most of the time, we go upstream and try to find the causes of illness. We need a new surge of interest and investment and maturity in the enterprises of public health, prevention, and wellness.
Tom Lee, speak to the sense I got from your book that, should we say, this new, what I call cathedral medicine, is soft on special interests, conflicts of interest, on big industry calling the tune.
Well, you know, I think that, and I would say I am not out of tune with Don, I think, on any of the things he said.
Out of tune.
Yeah, but what I will say is I am optimistic that the overall arc of the story is headed in the right direction. And, you know, I think ethics catches up with research after a lag. And I think understanding of conflicts of interest has been catching up, you know, after a lag. And, you know, we're always figuring out problems and fixing them. But I do think that we're in a new era with conflicts of interest. Like, you know, physicians where I practice at the Brigham are not allowed to take any gifts at all. Zero. You know, no more of these dinners or baseball games.
I got to challenge that. Steve wrote on our website when we first posted our interest in this whole subject. He said, I've been in the healthcare business for 25 years as a sales representative. The buildings keep getting bigger. The administration's more dense. The regulation more arcane. There is so much money thrown at healthcare. How could this not happen? In this uber nation, 30% clinically obese, he said, we're looking at an insane medical system that is a reflection of our society. And I don't see the countervailing pressures, powers, outrage, militancy.
Well, you know, I think that there,
humanity,
you know,
even.
You know, I think there is pushback. There's real change going on in healthcare now, in no small part due to people like Don. I mean, we have a much safer system than we did, you know, 15 years ago. It's, you know, we still have a way to go, and we'll always have a way to go. We'll never get it right. We'll always be pushing, and we'll always be fighting the side effects of progress, which will make things more challenging. But, you know, are people working now more to try to actually, you know, make healthcare affordable and to try to do prevention better? Yeah, I think but it's a painful redesign that's going on.
I don't hear it. People still puzzle about who sets the prices on a shoulder transplant or a knee fix? And nobody can rationalize a number. The surgeons themselves don't seem to know, you know, quite what they're charging and what it costs anybody.
You know, I actually think that that is very much in flux. You know, I came here from a discussion of bundled payment prices at Harvard Business School tonight, where, you know, the fact that there is a market, you know, Walmart, other big purchasers are negotiating bundled prices, which put pressure on institutions to get their doctors and hospitals work together to produce excellent outcomes for, you know, for a competitive price. That world is coming. So it's complicated, but I do see it happening. I am an optimistic guy.
Don Burke, I'm fascinated that you're out there on the stump in a governor's race making an issue of sort of how's to summarize your reform plan. But what do people say to you? And what kind of traction does it give you?
A lot of traction. I think the people all over the Commonwealth, anyway, they seem to know that things aren't quite right. They have a relative with a chronic illness whose name has been forgotten, who has to keep retelling their story. They've seen a complication develop that seems to be from excessive use of interventions. They want to deal with prevention and keeping the cells well, but they don't have the help they need. We have a big challenge here. We have to unwind a kind of addiction. It's a well-intended cycle, but it's addiction to more technology, more hope for miracles, more technology, more hope for miracles. But actually, the answers lie in the other direction. The next gleaming hospital tower isn't going to help us anything like the next investment in our Commonwealth, let's say, in working really hard on childhood asthma or substance abuse. I'd like to see substance abuse cut in this Commonwealth 50% in the next 5 or 10 years. We could do it.
Like how?
Well, we'd have to get social services revved up. We have to get all of the agencies that work with patients and families to surround the person who's really falling victim to substance abuse. That takes investment. We don't have the money for that investment, in part because the medical complex has grown so expensive, the most expensive in the world here, and we've got to be able to reverse that trend, or we won't have the resources to put into actually keeping people well.
How do people articulate that, the sense that medicine is one of the huge assets of this community? It's a growth industry. It's a global industry. It has an incredibly long, distinguished history in Boston, and at the same time, I don't want to say it's robbing us blind, but it's out of control.
Yeah, we have to celebrate and move on is what we need to do. I wouldn't want to go backward on the actually effective stuff that's been invented by giants like Gene Braunwald, but we have to understand keeping going down that pathway, building more and more technology, hoping for the robot that's going to cure us from an ill we could have prevented in the first place, it's just the wrong way to go. It's a fantasy. And I think Tom knows that. And I think that we need to kind of work with the public in a mature dialogue about how now to stay healthy and live long. And that's going to have to do a lot more with the way we lead our lives, with our attention to mental illness, with working on substance abuse and hazards and poverty in our society. That's the way to get health now.
But when you say that the bureaucratic and technology interest has taken over the system, who's your enemy then? Who are you campaigning against?
Well, I know a system in Anchorage, Alaska. I used to work in there called NUCA. In 5 years, using holistic approaches to care, prevention, wellness, nutrition, behavioral sciences, they've reduced hospital use 53% in 5 years. For a complex population, Alaska Natives in the Anchorage Bowl, they reduced specialty visits 65%. If I show up in one of those Boston hospitals today and say, hey, guys, I got an answer, I can reduce your admissions 53% in 5 years, that's going to be a very short conversation. We have to change the payment system so it becomes interesting for those organizations to say, ha, that's
take that apart. I don't get it. If you took it, they would say what?
They'd say, well revenue. We just built a new building. We have capitalized our new wing. We just hired 3 more cardiologists. They need to maintain the capital structures and the labor structures that support this interventionist world. If actually working on wellness would result in a decrease in the need for use of technologies, an empty hospital bed more valuable than a full one, that's a totally different business model. And the average hospital doesn't really at the moment have much knowledge about how to deal with that. I agree with Tom. This is going to change now. We're starting to see the momentum for change in payment and reimbursement systems so that better health is looking more lucrative to people who see themselves as healers. But that is a really big change in the business models of the organizations we have in this state and this nation.
Tom Lee, could Brigham and Women's deal with a big reduction in the use of its beds?
Oh, you know, and I think Don would agree, is that here in Massachusetts, we are a good 5, 6, 7 years ahead of the rest of the country in this change. And it's a wrenching change But, you know, 70% of the doctors in Massachusetts are in accountable care organizations who have contracts which are forcing the kinds of questions exactly like what Don's talking about. And, you know, it's hard. It's hard to, you know, it's fixing an airplane while it's flying. That's the analogy people use all the time. I actually think one of the challenges for us in this conversation tonight is here in Massachusetts, we actually, as great as our challenges are, we get a more optimistic view of change in the country than is probably accurate. I think,
you know, I'd say the rhetoric has changed. I think people now are embracing this. I just don't see the momentum yet, and I'm sensing I have a sense of urgency here. I think the clock is kind of ticking on this because the constant transfer of resources that we need for other purposes into a healthcare system that is constantly absorbing more and more is extremely costly. Monies are coming from our schools and our roads, the wages of laborers, the competitiveness of small and large businesses. And I think I'm sensing it's a time where a leisurely pace of progress isn't really going to work. And I hope we all get together and decide to actually make those changes, but I wouldn't say we're home yet.
What about the simple overprescription of meds, the overuse of fashionable treatments? I mean, these come in kind of waves that are embarrassing to look at, you know, over the long term. But suddenly, everybody I know, and if you're not having a joint replaced, you're somehow out of it. Stents are another. Shannon Brownlee's book on overtreatment lists all manner of studies in which cardiologists say that a huge proportion of major cardiological surgery is wrongly prescribed. And it has bad effects. How do these things happen, and more particularly, who blows the whistle on them?
Well, you know, I think that
stops them rather.
Yeah, you know, there definitely is overuse, and I actually think we're better off in Massachusetts than elsewhere in the country. But we have everywhere you look, there's variation. They're good people right next to each other, you know, and when some of them are using 30, 40, 50% less of things than other folks. So, and when there's that kind of variation, there's opportunity. And but I think that I don't think you can blow the whistle. I don't think you can like pass laws, pass rules. I think you have to have a change in the culture. As Don indicates, you need peer pressure. There's nothing like peer pressure to make someone feel humiliated in front of their colleagues because they are not practicing good medicine because they're profligate. And I may be optimistic. I being inside these organizations, I do feel like the culture is changing. I feel like, you know, the way smokers were made to feel like lepers eventually and have to go outside, the people who are churners are beginning to be treated like the lepers.
I think there's hope in professional leadership here. I do think that professions could rise to this occasion if they adopted what we used to call the triple aim: better care, better health, and lower cost at the same time. That would move us in the right direction. I think a lot of the problem is opacity. We just don't even know where the money flows. We don't understand the prices. The performance is not transparent. And if I could wave a wand, it would be moving us more toward high transparency about exactly where these resources are flowing and what we're getting for it. One of the sources of this is complexity in payment. As you know, in my political campaign, I'm arguing this state needs to take a close look at single payer. I think that would bring us into a system far simpler, where we could look more at where things are flowing and speak more for the public.
Make the case. Why single payer?
Oh, just follow a doctor or nurse through their day today. You'll watch billing procedures driving them crazy, formularies that vary, interfaces that don't work. And the patients, I mean, try to read your bill. I mean, I can't. We've added this complexity and paperwork to the system. And what it does, it puts a layer of opacity over exactly what is happening. And I would far prefer a simpler system, much like I ran at Medicare, where we were a single payer for 100 million Americans. And we knew the prices. We knew what was happening. It wasn't all good, but we knew what they were and we were accountable for it and could look at it. We kind of need that.
Can I tell you, I'm one of those 100 million and grateful to be among them. Of course, I don't know what the charges are, and I don't have any bargaining control over them either. But it's a nice place to be.
Yeah, it is a simpler system. The bargaining problem, and that's a political problem. Once we have a single payer, it still has to have clout. You know, Medicare can't even negotiate for drug prices for 100 million people, and we need to get over that.
Eugene Braunwald said to us, incidentally, that he's for single payer. He avoids political controversy. But I'm still wondering. I'd love your answer, Don, to put what I asked Tom Lee, which is simply, how integrally are these huge scientific, drug-funded, semi-commercial enterprises now, how are they sort of inevitably invested in waste and in overtreatment?
Well, the basic structure of a fee-for-service payment system, as Tom said, is you make more when you do more. So it's not necessarily a big, vicious plot, but absolutely all of the incentives go toward doing the next thing instead of not doing. That applies to pharmaceutical use, to the use of medical equipment, to diagnostic technologies, and even to hospital use. I think in their saner moments, all of these people know it's not good for us to keep that wheel spinning. But unless we wean ourselves off this fee-for-service payment system, we're going to be providing incentives simply to do more and more things.
And I think that there is complete agreement that the fee-for-service system, you know, has lots of toxic effects. I don't think anyone has a business model based upon get people to do unnecessary things. You know, virtually everyone is doing something that could help some people. But if it's done to a whole lot more than the people who might benefit, you don't see them questioning it very deeply.
I mean, at its worst, we do know there are organizations that actually have given incentive to emergency room doctors to admit patients to keep admission rates high. But that's luckily a small tale of really vicious behavior.
We're talking about restoring health to the whole project of healthcare. Just thinking about it reminded me of an extraordinary Boston doctor and teacher and clinician that we all know. Bernard Laun qualifies as a great scientist, not least for inventing the cardio defibrillator that became the pacemaker. He qualifies as a great humanitarian with his Nobel Peace Prize fighting nuclear weapons. And as a patient-centered doctor, he'll also tell you that science and technology are way overrated these days, maybe even in this conversation. This is what he told me yesterday.
Science is reductionist. Medicine is not a science. Medicine has to partake of science. If it doesn't partake of science, it's fish oil. I mean, snake oil medicine. But medicine can never be a science. It's too complex. That there's more complexity in the human being than the stars in the universe.
And then I asked Bernie Laun to read for me the key sentences of a call he issued recently for a renaissance in medicine.
People generally understand that medical care has become a huge industry, a hospital-centered sickness system, driven largely by financial incentives. For many patients, the system has been life-saving and even miraculous. For millions of others, the results have been under-treatment, over-treatment, and mistreatment. The striking shift from primary to specialist care has exacted multiple adverse consequences, including an escalation of procedures, excessive and unnecessary prescribing, and an erratic infatuation with technology. In my view, the lost art of listening and ignoring the patient as a human being is a quintessential failure of our healthcare.
That was Dr. Bernard Laun, a great cardiologist in his own right, and a representative of, shall we say, another tendency. I love that line about he didn't say neurotic infatuation, the erotic infatuation with technology. I love this emphasis on human complexity, unavoidable, but it barely registers in some of the new medicine. I like his emphasis, as always, on the lost art of listening. How do we embody that in the emerging medicine? Don Berwick.
You know, listening to Dr. Laun, I'm reminded of my first patient I ever saw. I had a tutor, a surgeon actually, Dr. Frank, Ed Frank at Beth Israel Hospital, and I walked into the room to see the patient and immediately began taking my history, and he put his hand on my shoulder. He said, no, Don, when you talk to a patient, you sit down. So I sat down and then I started taking my history. He said, no, Don, do you know that Mrs. Goldberg has a brand new grandson? That was not in the Red Book. That was not. He was saying, you got a whole person in front of you here. Let's understand that this is a brief episode in this person's life, and connecting to who this person is and what's important to them, and what their values are and what their assets are, that's going to make you a far better healer than you ever would be. We have to keep that in the center of the screen. That's what person-centered care means. It means I want to be respected. I want my choices, my values, my background to be part of the picture, to be the picture. And you can bring your technology to me, but please put it in the context of my life. That's healing. And we tend to lose that in the bells and whistles and machines that surround the patient. I think Dr. Brown, Dr. Bernie Lown is right. By the way, I must say that I think I've met no more gentle or respectful physician than Gene Brownwald, and I think this is not a combat between two giants. They both would agree. But the system has overtaken the focus on the person.
How do we get it back, Tom Lee?
Well, you know, I think it's really not getting it back. It's like creating a new synthesis where we don't – well, we're obviously not going to give up science and the technological advances, but how do we bring back some of those values that Dr. Lown was talking about and Don is alluding to? And I think we can. Now, I will say part of the challenge – I mean, tomorrow, you know, 12 hours from now, I'll be seeing patients, and I believe I'll be behaving in a way that Dr. Lown would approve as an individual doctor. But team care, team medicine is what it takes these days. Mm-hmm. Now, how do we work together in a way that allows patients to benefit from all the expertise, but also treats them like a human being? It's an active struggle, but it is active. You know, my colleagues and I are talking about this all day long. Mm-hmm. So again, I'm an optimist. I actually think Don's an optimist too, and he's just pushing us to.
But how
to
do we
faster.
Get it out of the going back frame? And I want to go back and make a sort of highfalutin literary reference here. To me, Bernie Lown always reminds me of a moment in Henry James's Wings of the Dove. Millie Teal is in London. She's desperately ill, but we don't really know why. Maybe tuberculosis. But she goes to the greatest doctor in London. In the novel, his name is Luke Strett on Harley Street. And he listens to her. And James has this one line. He says, half a bishop, half a general. Is the way he presents himself. But he sets metaphorically on the table in front of her a great empty bowl of attention. He just listens to this girl in terrific distress. And she leaves feeling she's been absolved. This is, I think, the feeling we long for from a doctor. Take in the whole picture here, doctor, and tell me, you know, in his case, he can't say he'll make her better. He has no cure. He does say, do go to Venice. Do go to Venice. But we long for that some human recognition.
Well, you know, I actually think that there's that, but there's something else new, which is a side effect of all the progress that we've been talking about this evening and the rise of modern medicine. You know, and so I work for this company, Prescani, now measures patient experience. And what we are finding is that patients are afraid. They are afraid that their care is not coordinated. They know there's so many people involved, and they are actively afraid that these people are not talking with each other. And all too often, you know, they're right. So besides the individual doctor listening to the individual patient, there's something else that's a skill for this time, which is how to work as a team, you know, and how to show patients that we're actually working with the team, because that's what they're afraid of. They're afraid of their disease, sure, but they're also afraid that we providers are not working together well. And there's so many, you know, like Atul Gawande counted 63 people coming through his mother's room when she was having a knee replacement or something like that. That number, I'm sure it's even higher than that, you know, if he had a full accurate count.
Is it a good sign or a bad sign to meet your doctor with a computer on his lap and his attention on the screen?
Well, I think...
Even if he's checking in with the team.
Right. You know, and I think that's obviously, it's not good manners and it's not good medicine, because if patients are also afraid that no one's listening to their worries as well. That's another thing that, you know, the data I've been looking at show. There are ways to... You can have your cake and eat it too. Where physicians can have all the information they need, and they're and they work well with, you know, non-physician, you know, personnel as well. Actually, accumulating information, you know, that's probably not the best use of time when you're with the patient. You know, from like looking at all the lab data, that should be done before they're in the room.
I should say that erotic fascination, infatuation with technology. I mean, that applies to everybody. All of us with an iPhone, but is there a cure for it in medicine specifically? I mean, like, shake them out of it. It's not in the numbers there.
I think you hit the nail on the head with the word listening. I think it has to do with opening our ears and our eyes to what's going on in the lives and the emotions and the vision of the people we're trying to help. One of the breakthroughs here, by the way, is to get the patient actively involved, the person actively involved in their own care. The modern view of this now, the one that I hope will take over, is that the person you're treating is on your team. They're with you as much, making as many decisions with you as you are making for them. And if I say in my whole field of quality, I've worked on quality of care for 30 years, and if there's one rule that I keep noticing, it's the more power the patient and the family and the community have in interacting with their own care, the better the care is. If you want to do one thing in a hospital or a clinic...
Those are several different things. I mean, community power, family power, individual power,
yeah,
to talk back to the doctor, but how do you build it?
Knowledge, invitation, making sure that it's an open field for conversation. Everyone brings the resources they have to bear on the help that the person needs, the person themselves, their family, and the community as a whole.
You remind me, my mother's obstetrician was on the golf course when she had her sixth child, and she refused to pay him. Simple as that. Sorry. And she got away with it.
Good
but,
for your mother.
But a lot of... Yeah. Of course, the bill would be vastly bigger today, and most people wouldn't think of that kind of...
Yeah, we need ways to help people learn to speak up. Your journalist colleague, Alan Goodman, has started this amazing program called The Conversation Project. You can find it at theconversationproject.org to help people begin to come to terms with and formulate their own views about how they want things to be as their lives close in the late stages of illness and end-of-life care. Mm. And it's all about mobilizing voice and a sense of power and a sense that, you know, after all, this is me, my book, my story, my life, and I should get the say.
I want to change the subject in two different directions. One, we speak of this program as a Boston Conversation with Global Attitude, and we got to assert that here. I mean, the medical problems of this world, the illness, the health crisis of the world is not in anybody's, you know, soon-to-be-replaced joint. It's in the poor world, and we know by now, and Paul Farmer would have told us anyway, that disease, illness festers in poverty. That's poverty. And Bernie Lund would say the same thing. Poverty is the cause of disease, and it goes there preferentially to hide out and to spread. So many of the things we're dealing with in Boston medicine seem almost like parody compared to the demands of the need in the larger world for this talent. How do we even begin thinking about that, or thinking about medical expenses in our society against the needs of the world?
The conversation demands a lot of maturity. Paul Farmer, for example, has been a very vivid spokesperson for one principle, which is the best technologies available in the world should be available to everyone in the world. He has no compunctions about evacuating a child from the heart of Rwanda or Haiti and bringing them to a place where that person can have a lung transplant. He thinks that's justice. I agree with him. But to replicate this investment in technology as the only way we really seek health in these very stressed countries, it will miss the point. These countries have resources. They have communities. They have spiritual approaches. They have the ability to think about nutrition and family supports together with illness. And I can see great models of truly integrated care emerging in these poor environments. We need to help them do that.
Tom Lee.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, we need people like Paul Farmer and Don Berwick, who have the audacity to think that these big global problems can be taken on. I actually think there's a link between that kind of audacity and the kind of audacity that led to the growth of medicine, that there are things that you don't accept things the way they are. It may be a stretch, but I think there's a link. And I think that I think our town actually cultivates that audacity as well as any city in the world.
But how specifically does the sort of stent era in American cardiology, Boston cardiology too, how does that relate to the needs of Rwanda or of Haiti?
Well, you know, the number, you know, it's interesting because the number of stents being put in is going down, down, down. And the number of physicians who can make their living doing angioplasty is going down, and their income's going down.
Around here?
Around the whole country. And the reason is because...
Not Florida, I don't think.
No. Everywhere in the country, and it's because prevention has been getting more attention, and people's cholesterols are being controlled. You know, statins are, you know, a big industry, but they're generics now, and so there's just a lot fewer people who are getting stents and who need them, and there are more guidelines, and you know who should get them, and peer pressure when people are putting them in for ridiculous reasons. You know, it's it is decreasing. Now, that said, we are still doing a whole lot of things in this country, but that, yes, you could take those resources and change the lives of thousands of people in other countries. You know, it's not simple to take a biologic medicine that costs $100,000 a year but helps someone with cancer live 2 months longer and send it overseas to some other place. But those are the kind of issues we have to grapple with.
Cardiologist friend of mine in Boston, you probably know him, says that when his patients go to Florida for the winter, they sometimes ask him, you know, have you got a approved doctor near Fort Lauderdale if I run into a problem? He says, yeah, Dr. Blue, Dr. Jet Blue, get on a plane and get out of there before they have their heart, you know, your heart on a plate. There's one other sort of general question that I think about in this overall discussion. We all revere Boston Medicine, and we know it's a huge ornament to this town and the history of this town. And we all have sort of favorite doctors. I think Bernie Lown would certainly be one of mine. Franny Moore, the late Franny Moore, was a marvel. Another one of those doctors who trained in World War II under extreme circumstances that made him a bold surgeon. Paul Dudley White, in my childhood, went to the Roxbury Latin School where I did, and he was Eisenhower's doctor, knew vastly less than cardiologists today, and yet is still somehow an example. He invented the bicycle path, really, and walking and exercise, simple things, and left that sort of simple mantra, listen to the patient, which is where Bernie Lown ends up too. But in the reinvention of Boston medicine, who do we want to think of as the face of this art and science in our own community and in the world?
Well, you know, I don't have a ready answer for you. I think there's a reasonable chance that face will not, you know, could well be female. It may not be Caucasian, and it may not be a name that any of us know.
Shocking.
Yeah, and it's the world has changed. And you look at who are the people coming through our training programs. You know, we don't look like the country. We look like the world now. And we've got tremendous talent, tremendous creativity in this town. And I think that as daunting as some of the problems we've talked about tonight are, I am confident that we will muddle through and we will take them on and we'll work things out.
Don Berwick.
Watch our public health sector develop, especially our community health centers. There's a marvelous program going on in Boston Medical Center now to get HIV/AIDS victims off the streets and into good care, taking substance abuse victims and really helping them rehabilitate. These are programs that do what Tom said. They're team-based programs that's not just about doctors. It's certainly not just about machines. It's creating environments where people can come and discover the power in themselves and benefit from team-based care. That's very different from the mainstream stuff you'll see in the flagship Boston hospitals, but it is great. And I think we will. I think Tom's right. We're going to be inventing some new care right here in this city, and it's going to be in primary care and communities.
I asked Dr. Braunwald if he were 20 years old again, entering the field, and had 60 years to burn, where would he set his ambition? And he said, in effect, that, you know, he lived through the age of the heart, the era of the heart, and the problems have been significantly resolved. But he thought we were entering the era of the brain and targeting Alzheimer's. My only hope would be that that too would not get lost in the counting of neurons and the erotics of technology, but that's another program. Thank you, Tom Lee. Thank you, Don Berwick, and thanks also to Bernie Lown and to Gene Braunwald. You can hear an extended interview with Gene Braunwald on our website, radioopensource.org. You can hear this whole program over and over again. We like to say the conversation isn't over until listeners have weighed in with a comment on the site. On the site, there are other extras too, like our podcast series, Reading Chekhov. Next week, the legacy of the young internet activist Aaron Swartz, who killed himself a year ago in the cause, apparently, of free information. We had help this week from the talented George Hicks on the controls at WBUR, from our executive escort, Sam Madden. We had generous support from the Friends of the Manning School in Jamaica Plain, and we're ever in debt to our chairman, Mike. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.